From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump has narrowed his list of 25 possible Supreme Court picks, and three names on that list are getting a lot of attention today. All three are conservative federal appeals court judges. Let's bring in NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And let's go through these. 46-year-old Amy Coney Barrett is one of the names, a graduate and former professor at Notre Dame Law School. Her writings on legal precedent are under scrutiny. Is she the one seen as the most likely to essentially overturn Roe v. Wade, the decision legalizing abortion?
No, I don't think she's seen as the most likely. I think every single one of these people were on the list compiled by the Federalist Society because they are considered to be reliable votes to either undermine or overturn Roe v. Wade. So I don't think there are huge ideological differences between the people on this list. She is significant. She is a woman, which many people feel would be the right person to pick right now, especially when Roe versus Wade hangs in the balance. Mm-hmm. Republicans feel she'd be harder to attack than a male candidate. She has an appealing profile. She has written, she's of course been on the bench for less than a year, but she's written about precedent in a way where she said that it's better for a judge to be true to the Constitution rather than to a precedent that he or she thinks was wrongly decided. Mm. So she's expressed a willingness to overturn precedent, but I don't think she's any more or less likely to overturn Roe v. Wade than the other ones.
What about 53-year-old Brett Kavanaugh, who worked in the George W. Bush White House and on the Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky investigations in the Bill Clinton presidency? We've heard conservatives think he may not be conservative enough.
One of the reasons that some conservatives are against Brett Kavanaugh is not so much that they think he won't be a reliable conservative vote, but that he has such deep ties to the Bush family, to the Bush administration, to Karl Rove, to everything that Donald Trump thought he was running against. Mm-hmm. But he has some things that should be very appealing to Trump after working on the Clinton Ken Starr investigation. He came to the conclusion that presidents should be shielded in certain ways from things like subpoenas or indictments. Hmm. So that might be something that Trump might look favorably on.
And then there is 51-year-old Raymond Kethledge, who is a Michigan Law School graduate. He's been called Gorsuch 2.0. What can you tell us about him?
Well, both he and Kavanaugh were Gorsuch were Kennedy clerks, and that would be the reason he's being called Gorsuch 2.0. One of the things that the Federalist Society and the Trump administration did very well is that they encouraged Kennedy to retire by picking Neil Gorsuch, a former clerk of his, and having a lot of former clerks of his on the short list so that he would feel comfortable that the court would be in good hands, the hands of his protégés, if he retired. So in that sense, Kethledge is another Gorsuch-type pick. But I think that I am not sensing big knockdown, drag out ideological fights inside the Republican Party or the conservative coalition where one of these picks is completely unacceptable. In other words, they're all pretty acceptable. Mm-hmm. People just have preferences.
Another story we're following today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo makes his third trip to North Korea this week, his first since the summit last month between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. The administration has a plan for North Korea to dismantle its nuclear and missile programs in 1 year. What can you tell us about that approach?
Well, John Bolton said over the weekend that he thinks they could be dismantled in 1 year. We don't know if he said that to kind of undermine the negotiations because of his past preferences against negotiating with North Korea. But 1 year is considered pretty unrealistic by most people. Sure, if North Korea all of a sudden had a complete total change of heart and decided to get rid of its entire nuclear program, it is technically possible they could get rid of it in a year. But North Korea hasn't made any indication that it is interested in doing that. On the contrary, we have reports that there are satellite images of them continuing to build nuclear facilities. So far, no real hard and fast evidence to back up Donald Trump's claim that North Korea is, quote, no longer a nuclear threat.
So we're waiting for the Supreme Court nominee to be named on Monday. And then, of course, President Trump heads off to Europe, and he'll be in England, and he'll be meeting with NATO allies, and then with Vladimir Putin. We'll be following all of that. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
Rodney Smith Jr. is mowing lawns this summer, not only at his home in Huntsville, Alabama, but in every state, including Alaska and Hawaii. His nonprofit organization is called Raising Men Lawn Care Service. He recruits young men and women to mow the lawn of people who need the help and do it for free. Rodney, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you for having me.
Which state are you in right now?
I'm currently in Billings, Montana.
So how many states does this make?
This makes 41 states, I believe. Yeah, so 9 more to go.
And your next stop after this will be where?
My next stop is North Dakota.
How does it work? How do you find out about the lawns that need mowing?
Before I started the tour, I made a request to my followers if they knew anyone in the cities and states I'll be going to. So I selected a city in each state where I'll be going to, and I put it out. And people just start submitting lawns of those who are elderly, disabled, single moms, and veterans. And that's how it all happened.
And then once you get to a city, how many lawns do you mow?
I mow an average of 3 to 4 lawns per city. Sometimes it's more. Like yesterday in Casper, Wyoming, I had about 5 to 6 lawns. So it was a pretty busy day.
And do you bring the mower with you?
Oh, yeah. So I'm driving around in all 40 states in my SUV. I have a Ford Edge. I just pack my lawnmower in the back with my weed eater and blower, and I just drive along.
And what are you going to do when it comes to Alaska and Hawaii?
For Alaska and Hawaii, I would either borrow someone's lawnmower or I'll buy one, then donate it to a kid who's taking part in the 50-yard challenge that we are hosting.
Yeah, that's right. So you've recruited a lot of young men and women. How many at this point?
We have a total of about 180 kids taking part in our 50-yard challenge, including 1 in Canada and 7 in Bermuda and England that are taking part in this challenge. So let's say you had a kid in New York that accepted this challenge. All they would need to do is make a sign saying, I accept the 50-yard challenge, and in return, we send them a white Raising Men Lawn Care Service t-shirt along with shades and ear protection. Once they mow 10 lawns, they get an orange shirt, 20 a green, 30 a blue, 40 a red, and 50 a black. And once they reach 50, we fly to them, we do lawns with them, and we also give them brand new lawnmowers. So to date, 12 kids nationwide have completed this.
That's pretty great. You know, lawn mowing is you know, one of those necessary evils, I think, for people who are lucky enough to have a lawn.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people like to do it, especially in the heat. And you know it well. So why are you doing it?
I'm just trying to encourage kids to get out there, you know, and make a difference. Too many kids are inside playing video games. And what I'm doing, I believe it's my purpose. I remember a few years ago, I had a one-on-one conversation with God, and I asked him to use me as his vessel. He didn't give me an answer that day, not a week later, not even a month later. It happened a few years later in 2015 when I came across an elderly man outside mowing his lawn, and it looked like he was struggling, so I pulled over and I helped him out. At the time, I was getting my bachelor's in computer science, so I thought I could mow 40 lawns by the end of winter. But I mowed 40 lawns so quick that I upped my goal to 100. And a month and a half later, I reached my 100th lawn, and that's when I came up with the idea of Raising my lawn care service.
And what do people say to you? What's it like when you go up to a house?
At first, they're shocked, and then they're really appreciative, you know, because a lot of the lawns that I'm doing, some are real high. I remember just a few days ago, this lady, she was a widow for a few years, and she just let the lawn go because her husband used to take care of the lawn. But I came in and mowed it for her, and had it been cut in probably 3 to 4 years.
Well, not to be a killjoy, but does it ever bother you that after this really generous gesture of mowing somebody's lawn, you know it's going to need it again in a couple of weeks?
That's the reason why I'm trying to encourage kids in each state to join our 50-yard challenge to take on the responsibility because they're able, you know?
Rodney, how do you make a living?
Well, I recently just graduated from college. I just got my master's in social work. And this whole organization made me find my true purpose, which is helping people, and this is what made me go back. So I just graduated May 4th with my master's in social work. So now that we're a nonprofit, my goal is to run the foundation full time and hopefully make it a national organization someday. So that's the big goal.
The young men and women who are doing this as part of the foundation around the country, if they or I should say when they complain, because who doesn't when you're doing a lawn, what do you tell them?
I let them know that they're making a difference. I remember one kid we had, he came out for the first time with us in Huntsville, where I'm based out of. And at first he was like, I don't want to do this. But after he finished his first lawn, it was for an elderly man. And I asked him on camera, how does it feel to know that he made a difference? And his face lit up. He said, oh, did you see his face just now? I done finished his lawn. And he had a big smile on his face and he thanked me. Oh, man, oh, man. I mean, it's priceless just to see his face just light up after he done his first lawn. And that's the kind of reaction a lot of the kids are giving us. So it's really cool to see such a small idea grow into something that is inspiring kids nationwide and even worldwide.
Rodney Smith Jr., founder of Raising Men Lawn Care Service. He's on a mission to mow 50 lawns in 50 states, and he's now in his 41st state in Billings, Montana. Rodney, it's so nice to speak with you. Thank you, and stay cool.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you so much.
To see pictures of Rodney and a group of his young recruits, go to hereandnow.org. Over the last 20 years, one-sixth of all counties in the United States have lost a local newspaper, and studies have found that newspaper closures may lead to a decrease in voter turnout and an increase in local corruption. Now a team of economists is suggesting that there are economic consequences, too. They've completed a report finding that when newspapers close, taxpayers lose. Dermot Murphy co-authored the study. He's a professor of finance at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Dermot, thanks a lot for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the program.
What is the relationship between a local newspaper closing and the economic consequence in a city or town?
So our intuition was that if a local newspaper closes, then they are no longer providing a crucial watchdog role for local governments. And when a local government isn't being watched, they are more likely to engage in bad behavior and just be more inefficient in general.
So that's what you posited.
Yes, that's correct. And so we thought, if a government is more likely to engage in bad behavior, then somebody that is lending to a local government might have to ask for a higher interest rate to compensate for the risk of lending to an irresponsible local government, essentially.
Well, you're assuming that the local government would be irresponsible, and that's the way the investors would think because of the lack of a newspaper?
Yes, that's correct. So the newspaper is there to keep the government in check, and without them, then the government knows they are not being watched, and so they are just more likely to be inefficient, and we have data that bears that out.
So tell us about that. How did you crunch the data?
So we collected newspaper closure data from the editor and publisher yearbooks, and then we cross-referenced this information with government borrowing cost data from the Emergent Municipal database. And so what we find is that government interest rates significantly increase after a newspaper closure.
Just to clarify, if a town wants to build a $65 million hospital or, say, a bridge, it doesn't just have the money lying around, so it has to attract investors and issue bonds. And that's where the higher interest rate comes in.
Yes, that's exactly true. So we often call it an issue. So you have to issue a series of bonds to fund your school, hospital, or a roadway. And you have to pay interest rates on the money that you borrow. And we find that the interest rates go up by about 0.1 percentage points, which does correspond to about $650,000 per issue.
And this is money that is ultimately paid by the taxpayer.
It is, yes. The taxpayer will ultimately foot the bill for the extra cost borne by local governments.
Give us an example.
I think an interesting city right now is Denver, Colorado. So the Rocky Mountain News closed in 2009, and we do find that borrowing costs in the long run did increase in the area by about 30 basis points. And the cuts at the Denver Post indicate that the problems might continue to worsen in that city.
The cuts in the Denver Post that have been more recent, because the Rocky Mountain News closed back in 2009, there had been a large investigative arm of the Rocky Mountain News, especially in doing stories about the new airport in Denver. So how close a link can you draw between the closing of the newspaper and the reduction now in the Denver newspaper and what's happening economically there?
So at the very least in our data, we try to establish causation by looking at a county that experienced a newspaper closure and a neighboring county that is matched on demographic and economic characteristics that did not experience a newspaper closure.
So that's the control.
Yeah, that's the control. And we do find that the borrowing costs do go up in the treatment county, but not in the control county.
Roughly by how much on average?
On average, about 10 basis points, 0.1 percentage points.
What does that mean in terms of money? What's the range?
So 0.1 percentage points on an average issue size of $65 million corresponds to a total interest cost of about $650,000, and that's just for one issue.
And how much of this is coming back to the taxpayer to pay for?
So if you look at the average cost to the taxpayer, at least we find in the second part of the paper that this can cost the average taxpayer about $70 per person.
How do we know that this is not sort of a chicken and egg thing? I mean, perhaps the economy is bad to begin with in a particular locale, and that's why a newspaper might have less advertising and why it might have to close.
That's the beauty of the treatment versus control county test. If you look at a county in a neighboring county that is the same economically, then it is unlikely that it would be driven by economic conditions because yields or borrowing costs should go up in both counties. But we only see borrowing costs going up in the county that experienced the newspaper closure and not the neighboring county that is matched on economic characteristics.
And in those counties, is there nobody else who can fill that watchdog role when a local newspaper exits? There's radio, TV. Even the citizenry?
So we think that local TV stations do perform an important function, but I think that they're spread a little thin these days. So it's difficult for a city newspaper and the local TV station to cover all the municipalities surrounding a city, for example.
Is there any hope in this for those communities that are losing newspapers and fear what the repercussions might be?
You know, I still think we haven't quite reached an equilibrium yet. You know, I think that the internet, it's still relatively new in the grand scheme of things. And I think in the future, it's possible that national news outlets will start to tailor their news to local areas. And so then you'll see more sort of investigative reporting at the local level. So I do hold out hope that there will be a resurgence in high quality investigative journalism at the local level in the future. But it's hard to see where we're going right now.
Dermot Murphy, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
The UN estimates the world has hit a record when it comes to the number of refugees. 68.5 million people have been forced from their homes, people fleeing violence in places like Syria, Myanmar, El Salvador, and Honduras. Well, there's a museum in Sandy Spring, Maryland, that's exhibiting artworks made by refugees. And as Carmel Del Shad of member station WAMU reports, their works go beyond the refugee experience.
Khaled Al-Aini stands inside a light-filled exhibit hall at the Sandy Spring Museum. He looks at two of his paintings hanging side by side, entitled Immigration.
It's kind of a description of a journey as a refugee and what's mean to be a refugee.
The unnamed woman in his paintings is depicted in two key moments in her life, while she's fleeing her homeland and after she's fled. The colors in each are rich with symbolism. In the first painting, her dress is a fiery orange-red, and her eyes are dark, clouded, and pensive. She stands arms at her sides, waiting at a crosswalk, with her hair blowing in the wind.
It's a symbol of crossing from one side, from one world to another world.
And when she finally does make it to the other side, the other world, as Al-Aini puts it, there's a visible sense of relief in her expression. But in this painting, her eyes are hooded, almost as if she lives permanently in those crucial moments between being awake and falling asleep. As she sits in a chair with a baby in her arms, a bright red cloud looms over her head. She may be safe now, but her memories of back home always remain.
It's just like the memory that we keep in our heart for the place that we live or the people that we love.
For Al-Aini, these pieces of art imitate life. Just like the woman in his paintings, he too is a refugee. Al-Aini fled Iraq in 2006 for Syria, only to find another war breakout there too. He is all too familiar with the concept of being displaced. Al-Aini is one of six refugee artists featured in an exhibit titled Uprooted, on display now at the Sandy Spring Museum.
It's a really meaningful project.
Museum director Allison Weiss says she hopes visitors walk away with a clear message that refugees' lives are about more than just their immigration status. And not every painting of the exhibit reflects the artist's journey to America. Some depict women dressed in colorful attire at a market in Ethiopia, and others pay tribute to last year's Women's March on Washington.
It gives us a chance to see people as a whole rather than thinking of people as a refugee. We're thinking them as artists and as people who moved here and built new lives.
While the artists may not be household names in America, at least not yet, some were well known in their homelands. Araki Ahmed Al-Karhi fled the ongoing violence there in search of stability and settled in neighboring Syria. There he met Khaled Alani, who recalls feeling a bit starstruck when they were first introduced.
At that time, I was just starting doing my paintings. But I remember I met him a couple of times, and he really encouraged and supportive.
Al-Karhi is soft-spoken, but has an easy smile. As we walk through the exhibit, peering from one painting to the next, he describes how his work has changed since he moved to America. His paintings used to feature very neutral, earthy tones, sandy beiges and ruddy browns. But once he arrived in the U.S., he found a kaleidoscope of colors.
When I go outside, everywhere different, house different, landscape, I confuse. And I say, let me do something special.
Al-Karhi started incorporating more colors into his landscapes and portraits. The deep greens of trees, the haziness following an afternoon storm.
I go outside, I saw too many color. I feel like music, like singing, yeah.
Al-Karhi is a bit of a style chameleon. His work can't be classified as purely modern or abstract, and he loves changing his method and style with each piece he creates. And he says he isn't intimidated by blank canvas.
When I go to white canvas for painting, I say, you know, I dance with you, and I play.
And if anything, Al-Karhi says, his new home provides another canvas to dance with each time he picks up a paintbrush. For Here and Now, I'm Carmel Dalshad. His new home provides another canvas to dance with each time he picks up a paintbrush. For Here and Now, I'm Carmel Dalshad.
Just after midnight Eastern time tonight, another round of U.S. trade tariffs go into effect, this time on $34 billion worth of Chinese machinery, auto parts, and medical devices. And China says it'll respond immediately with equivalent tariffs on U.S. products. Joining us now is Charisse Jones, reporter at USA Today. Hi, Charisse.
Hello.
And U.S. businesses are very worried about this. What does this mean for them?
You know, they're really going into triage mode. They are trying to rush shipments to China before the tariffs hit. They're considering making their products overseas to get around the tariffs. In some cases, they're selling the products at a loss so that they can keep their customers. So they are really pulling out all of the stops to kind of ward off what they think could be potentially catastrophic for a lot of industries.
So that they can keep their customers, meaning that they think maybe these tariffs will go away at some point and then they'll just be able to get back to business as usual?
Yeah, that, you know, if there's eventually a reprieve or there's a meeting and calmer minds prevail, they want to still be in the spot with certain companies and mm-hmm. you know, certain countries that have imposed these taxes. And so they're just trying to do whatever they can to say, you know, we still want to play ball even if our government is taking these actions.
So what are the industries that are going to be impacted the most here?
There's so many, but some of the biggest ones are soybeans, the pork industry, SUVs, even whiskey. They're being very strategic in the products that they're targeting, kind of going after what's made in the red states that went overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in the mm-hmm. presidential election. Those are the ones that are really in the most jeopardy.
Well, let's talk about pork, because China has said they're going to charge a 25% tariff on imported pork. From the U.S., I saw that the owner of the largest family-owned pork producer told CNBC, the industry has been asked to be good patriots, but I don't want to be the patriot who dies at the end of the war. So pork producers are really worried.
It's a great line because basically you're shutting the door on the biggest pork consumer in the world. China consumes more pork than any other country. One in four hogs that are grown in the United States are exported. And so with this latest tariff, basically the tax on pork products would get up to around 80%. I mean, that's astronomical. So clearly China will go elsewhere to get their pork products, and they're going to lose a major customer, you know, if you're in the pork industry. And so they're very, very worried about the fallout from this.
And cheesemakers also worried. And I think cheese, I'm thinking Wisconsin. If it's made in America, this is a state that went for President Trump. This is Scott Walker, the Republican governor's state. They're going after Wisconsin, it sounds like, with the cheese tariffs.
Absolutely. You know, milk consumption has been really drying up in the United States. And so they've been turning to making more cheese and really targeting the middle classes over in Asia and in Mexico. Those foreign markets have really saved that industry. They've really been a lifeline because prices really plummeted in the last few years because there was overproduction. So certainly Wisconsin and other states where that industry employs a lot of people are very concerned about that lifeline being cut off.
Anybody not worried about these tariffs right now?
You know, Wall Street hasn't really responded in a significant way at this point, but I think it's safe to say that, you know, lawmakers are even chiming in that, you know, these tariffs are really going to be devastating for a lot of people, really endanger a lot of livelihoods. And so I think everyone is hoping that there's going to be a last minute reprieve and that they won't take place.
That's Charisse Jones, a reporter at USA Today. Charisse, thank you.
All this summer, we're offering recommendations for books you might want to check out. You can find links to some of our summertime picks at hereandnow.org. Today, Francine Prose, the author of 21 books of fiction, including the National Book Award-winning Blue Angel. She's a distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. Her latest nonfiction is a collection of essays called What to Read and Why. Francine Prose, what made you want to compile these book picks?
Well, it's been my experience, and I think it's many writers' experience, that people are always asking you, what should I read or what are you reading? And when I was traveling and talking to people about my previous book, Reading Like a Writer, I would have to say, well, there's a reading list at the end, and just go to the reading list and look at what I recommend. And it was sort of frustrating because you can't really talk to people in depth. So one of the things that I enjoyed about putting this book together was my ability to say, I think you should read Great Expectations, and here's 3,000 words about why I think so. And it was kind of a challenge to try and convince people to read these books that I love without spoiling the experience of reading for them.
So why don't you take Great Expectations first then? I mean, we know it's a classic. Many of us read it in school. Why read it right now, especially, you know, it's summertime? Is this really a summer read?
Dickens is incredibly entertaining. I mean, he wrote, one of the things I liked about writing the essay was to talk about how he wrote it, which was that he had started a magazine, which was serialized fiction. So he'd done Tale of Two Cities for the magazine, and they did Wilkie Collins' novel. And then the magazine was about to go out of business because they had another writer whose work wasn't selling. So Dickens said, okay, to save the magazine, I'm going to write a novel in serial form. And it turned out to be Great Expectations. I mean, it's such a beautiful, you know, people remember Miss Havisham and so forth. But just in terms of psychology and detail and dialogue and plot development and set pieces, it's just a fantastically beautiful novel.
Yeah, Dickens is entertaining. And not that we have to necessarily be entertained, but it's a great read. But why, among all the great reads, bring this one up now?
Well, it has a lot to do with moral development, which I think is a really important subject at the moment, and with class consciousness, and with looking at who you are and what your aspirations are and how you act in society like a morally conscious human being, which I can't think of a more appropriate time to think about all those subjects.
There's another author from a different century. This is from the last century, Mavis Gallant, and you profile the collected stories of Mavis Gallant. You say that in 30 years of teaching, you almost always include one or two of her stories in your courses. Why is that?
Well, she's an exquisite writer to look at if you're trying to talk about close reading, because she was just a master of subtext, so that when you talk about her stories with students, you can say, what's this sentence saying on the surface? And then look at all the things that the sentence is saying under the surface if you really look at it carefully enough, so that at the end, the story becomes a kind of summation of not only the things that you've read, but the things that have been put in your consciousness because they've been just underneath the outside surface of what you've read.
So is this for the casual reader or the student of writing?
Well, both. They're also fun. Did I not make that clear? I mean, they're funny.
You include the author Patrick Hamilton in your book, and his novels, you write, quote, are dark tunnels of misery, loneliness, deceit, and sexual obsession, illuminated by scenes so funny that it takes a while to register the sheer awfulness of what we just read. Why did you choose Hamilton?
What I've written makes it sound great, huh?
Because
he's such a good writer and so entertaining. And I think, you know, lately more people have been reading the Patrick Melrose novels by Edward St. Aubin, which I also talk about in this book. But in a way, Hamilton was like a precursor of St. Aubin. I mean, that is, his writing was similarly dark, witty, also entertaining, and just beautifully written. Let me read one little quote, which I just love, and it's typical of his style. And this is from one of his books called 20,000 Streets Under the Sky. This is a woman who's thinking about drinking and why she likes it. A permeating coma, a warm haze of noises and conversation wrapped her comfortably around, together with something more. What that something more was, she did not quite know. She sat there and let it flow through her. It was a glow and a kind of premonition. It certainly was spiritual, but a much more emphatically a physical premonition of good about to befall. It was like the effect on the body of good news without the good news.
Hmm.
Which is like something that Edward St. Aubin might have written, but it was written decades before and by Patrick Hamilton. Plus his novels. I mean, he's the kind of writer whom I love to recommend because he's not widely known. One of the reasons that I wrote this book or put together this book was my feeling everybody should be reading these books because they're so great.
Why did you include, well, I guess because you think it's great, but why did you include a book by Gita Sarangi? It's a book about a true crime that might be hard for readers to take. It's called Cries Unheard, a profile of a woman who, as an 11-year-old, killed two small children. It's somewhat controversial because the author actually paid the woman later in life for her story. Why did you include it?
Well, because I think Gita Sarangi was one of the great writers of the last century, and because all of her books are extraordinary, because her lifelong project, she had two projects. She was a Hungarian journalist who had to leave Hungary and during the World War II, and her two projects were children who have been subjected to trauma of one sort or another and the origins of evil. So this was one of her more famous books, but then she wrote two books, one about Albert Speer, the architect of the Nuremberg rallies and Hitler's architect, and one about the commandant of the Treblinka extermination camps. And in both cases, she went to interview people who no one interviewed. She talked to people who no one talked to. She tried to understand what made these people tick and why they wound up doing the things that they did. And she brought a similar approach to the story of Mary Pell, the child murderer, looking at her childhood, her horrendous relationship with her mother, and to try and understand why she committed the crime she committed and what had happened to her in prison and why she came out of prison a kind of reconstructed human being. So again, I can't think of anything more timely if we need desperately to understand people who don't think the way we do and whose actions we think are appalling. Read Gita Sarangi and try and figure out what an approach might be to understanding who they are and why they do the things they do.
That book is called Cries Unheard. We'll be putting a list of all the books and the authors that you're recommending on our website, hereandnow.org. Two more things that are very topical. One is a book by a Pakistani-born author, Mohsen Hamid, Exit West, which you call a real novel about the daunting subject of the global refugee crisis, especially relevant right now. Is that why you included it?
Yeah. And I mean, he's a great writer. And also he's a real novelist. So I was struck over and over again by the brilliance of his inventions and by the things he found to help him do things. I mean, for example, there are these kind of slightly supernatural things that happen in the novel. And one of them is that there's a kind of portal through which these characters go as they become refugees and are chased from place to place. And it's just a portal, and it allows them to go from point A to point B instantly within the space of a paragraph, rather than Hamid having had to narrate their entire journey from place to place. And I thought, what a brilliant way of saving yourself the trouble of pages about a journey that people think they might know the details of, and just getting his characters to the next place they have to be.
Why don't we finish up on the novels of Jane Austen? They've always been extremely popular, in part for her humor, but you say she's also a keen observer of economic conditions. How so?
Well, she understood, you know, why do her characters so desperately need to get married? I mean, it's partly for love, and partly those books are about finding someone you love to marry, but it was also an economic consideration. I mean, the fact that property and money were not left to women, so women had to find other ways to survive economically and financially, mostly through marriage. I mean, fortunately, most of that is gone by now, but she was so astute in understanding the ways in which money and finance affected everybody's everyday behavior.
And which would you recommend?
Oh, Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility. You can't go wrong. I mean, they're all so great.
And Francine, in summary, you've given us a lot to read and the specific reasons why we should read each of these. But in aggregate, what's the thrust behind these recommendations in their entirety? What do you want us to get from them?
Well, I would just like people to keep reading and to keep reading really good books. And what are the reasons for reading? I mean, they're different for everyone, of course, but among them are pleasure or wisdom or understanding other human beings or appreciating someone's use of the language. I mean, there are endless numbers of reasons, and all of them seem important to me, and all of them are reasons why I keep writing and keep reading.
Francine Prose, thank you for all your recommendations. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Francine Prose's newest book is called What to Read and Why.
Britain's Home Secretary today accused Russia of using his country as a dumping ground for poison after a second incident involving the nerve agent Novichok. Sajid Javid spoke in the House of Commons today.
The eyes of the world are currently on Russia, not least because of the World Cup. It is now time that the Russian state comes forward and explains exactly what has gone on.
The current case involves a couple from Amesbury in the UK who fell ill last weekend. They're hospitalized and in critical condition. And this comes after an ex-Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter Yulia were poisoned in March. British officials said that was an attempted assassination by Russia. Joining us now is BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera in London. And Gordon, Russia denied any involvement in the Skripal case. Is the Home Secretary saying Moscow was involved in this new case?
Well, the working assumption from a lot of people you speak to in the national security world is that this effectively is the leftovers of the Skripal case. So that what they think is it's the same kind of nerve agent, the same type of Novichok, the same type that was used in the Skripal poisoning, which may have poisoned this couple. Now, the assumption is that perhaps it was something that was left behind after that attack and that had been dumped somewhere, and then that this couple came across it a few months later and that they were then contaminated by it. Now, that's the kind of working assumption, I think, for investigators who are currently looking for more evidence.
And when you say came across it, that they just got close to it or that they picked it up, or what do
we
know?
We don't know. So I think we have to be very clear about what we know and what we don't know. We do know it's the same nerve agent that was used in the previous case. We don't know how. We do know with the Skripals it was their doorknob. We believe that it was smeared on it. So we don't know how this couple, whether it seems possible they may have picked something up. I think that would be the most likely hypothesis, that perhaps there was something used in that original poisoning back in March that was dumped somewhere, perhaps in a park, and that this couple then picked it up and then were contaminated, because the Novichok is persistent. In other words, it doesn't decay over time, but you do have to touch it. It has to get into your system somehow, whether it's absorbed through the skin or ingested or some other way.
But the idea is that this was probably an accident, not on purpose.
Again, that's the assumption. The reason being that with the Skripals, you could see why someone, if you believe it's Russia, then Russia would want to target them. This was Sergei Skripal, was a former Russian spy who they regarded as a traitor. This couple in Amesbury, there is absolutely no plausible reason that anyone has seen why they would be targeted by something as unusual as a nerve agent. No one's come up with a plausible scenario for that. So I think accidental contamination is much more likely. And given the proximity to where the Skripals were, given the fact it's the same nerve agent, that's the working hypothesis for the investigators.
So how is Russia responding to this?
Well, they've rejected the accusation. They rejected it, of course, in the Skripal case. And they've just said this is more lies from Britain. There have been some people in Russia saying, well, this is all an attempt to undermine the World Cup, which is going on in Russia, and it's an attempt to, you know, because it's going well. So I think that's the response we've had so far, and effectively what you would expect from the Russians, given their previous position with the Skripal case, where they said, you know, we didn't do it. We weren't involved. Mm.
Meanwhile, I'm sure that the people in Amesbury, in this area where this couple was poisoned, must be very worried, because there had been a cleanup operation, but clearly it may not have turned out the way that they hoped.
Absolutely. I think that is the biggest concern for people in that area, is what else might there be? I mean, it is worth saying that it's 4 months on and this is the only person, or these are the only people who seem to have been contaminated. But still, the idea that it was something which was not discovered is going to be of great concern. I mean, it's interesting. When you go to the cleanup operation, what they did was go to all the sites that the Skripals visited that day that they were poisoned, and they've decontaminated all those sites. Now, what's significant is that this couple, the assumption is that they didn't get poisoned at any of those sites, they think. So in other words, it is not somewhere where the Skripals were, which then again points to the possibility this had something to do with whoever poisoned the Skripals, perhaps dumping something afterwards, or it's where they prepared it, and something was left behind which this couple came across. But again, we have to be clear, that's an assumption, a hypothesis, rather than something that's been proven.
What's happened to the Skripals?
They were in hospital for a while. I mean, what's striking is, of course, the thought when we first heard about they'd been poisoned with a nerve agent was that they were going to die.
Right.
And in fact, they made a remarkable recovery and both have been discharged from hospital. Yulia made a brief TV statement on camera. Sergei Skripal has not appeared at all. But they were treated very quickly. There was some good fortune that there were some people at the local hospital who knew something unusually about kind of chemical weapons and were able to give them the right treatment quickly. And so they actually made a far better recovery than anyone expected. And I think the hope will be that something similar happens with this couple from Amesbury.
That's BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera joining us from London. Gordon, thank you.
Thank you.
And this update on this developing story this afternoon, British police now say the couple in Amesbury got sick after handling a contaminated item, but they are still trying to determine the source of that contamination. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Robin Young. This is Here and Now.